Hello everyone, I'm Amanda Balbi, Managing Editor at Consultant360.com. Today I'm joined by Dr. T.S. Dharmarajan, who is the Vice Chairman of the Department of Medicine, Clinical Director of the Division of Geriatrics, and the Program Director of the Geriatric Medicine Fellowship Program at the Wakefield campus of Montefiore, the University Hospital of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. Dr. Dharmarajan will speak with us today about hypertension in the elderly population. Thank you for speaking with us today, Doctor.
Thank you, Amanda. My talk on hypertension will be a review of the guidelines and evidence with a focus on older adults. Disclosures-wise, there is none by way of industry or any other form of support. The objectives will be to discuss the different guidelines that have come out on hypertension, discuss target values for treatment, a brief review of trials on hypertension, and strategies that will work in the older adults. The first comment to be made is that most studies on hypertension do not include the very old, the ones who are sick with comorbidities and physical and cognitive disabilities. And so as such, the guidelines do not really provide evidence-based recommendation as applicable to older adults, and significant gaps exist in this regard. As basic information, systolic blood pressure increases with age in both men and women. The diastolic, on the other hand, plateaus somewhere in the 50s to 60s and goes down and accounts for the wide pulse pressure that you see with aging. So you get essentially an elevation of systolic blood pressure and a lowering of diastolic blood pressure. There is also a hypothesis that a J-shaped curve exists, at least for systolic blood pressure, meaning that if the blood pressure goes down below 130 to 120 systolic, there may be an association with adverse events, and we are referring to cardiovascular events. Resistant hypertension refers to that form of hypertension where control appears unsuccessful even with three or more drugs used in full doses, including a diuretic. 10 to 15% of patients who have hypertension have resistant hypertension. And a term called refractory hypertension is a subset of those who have resistant hypertension, seen largely in males with a higher BMI, and those with prior cardiovascular or other forms of vascular disease. These patients tend to also have diabetes, and they truly are very difficult to control. The factors associated with an increase in blood pressure in the old include changes in the blood vessel, a stiffening of blood vessels, salt sensitivity, increased sympathetic activity, and perhaps a volume component brought on by excess sodium intake or by the presence of renal dysfunction. Inadequate diuretic therapy also contributes to inadequate blood pressure control. Associated conditions such as obesity or secondary causes of hypertension, and in particular, drug-related hypertension may play a role. A word about drug-induced or drug-related hypertension. It pays to be knowledgeable about the very many different kinds of classes of drugs that can contribute to an elevation in the blood pressure, either by causing changes in the vasculature or salt retention, or by antagonizing the other antihypertensives that are taken. Examples include NSAIDs, including the COX-2 inhibitors, sympathomimetics or decongestants, oral contraceptives, adrenal steroids, some antidepressants, and common but less well known is the use of licorice, which contains a substance that behaves like aldosterone and causes salt retention. This substance is glycyrrhiza. This is just a partial list of drugs. So a drug screen would be vital in those who are hypertensive and especially those who are poorly controlled. When one approaches hypertension, one must consider, are there risk factors? Is there target organ damage? Are there identifiable causes, such as what I already mentioned? The physical exam, a choice of laboratory tests, and management, which includes lifestyle and medications. In particular, one should be aware of the fact that the DASH diet, which was introduced many years ago, 20 years ago, rich in fiber, potassium, magnesium, fruits, vegetables, beans, nuts, whole grains, low in fat but high in protein, with a limitation of sugar and saturated fat, was effective in general for health. The DASH diet is not a low sodium diet, but a DASH diet combined with a reduction in sodium intake would add substantial value to not only hypertension, but the many other coexisting disorders that such patients may have, such as diabetes or obesity. So providers must learn to adopt the DASH diet and tweak the diet for hypertensives. A study done in this country from the NHANES data, National Health and Nutrition Evaluation Survey data, which looked at a variety of factors, largely different kinds of foods that were taken, such as fruits, vegetables, nuts, grains, meats, sugar, fat, and salt, found that the biggest relationship, the highest proportion of cardiometabolic death that could be linked to dietary ingredients were largely related to excess sodium intake. And this is particularly true in hypertensives. So I just want to emphasize the importance of sodium intake in management. The next factor one should also address is the issue of adherence, formally termed compliance. Non-adherence increases with a complicated regimen, with increase in the number of medications and doses, and essentially the complexity of care, such as polypharmacy, frequent testing, transportation issues, scheduling of patients, etc., etc. Complexity of care adds barriers. So in general, when you deal with a hypertensive, it is important to keep the regimen simple, have a sense of empathy towards the patient, and build trust. And last but not least, keep costs in mind. With that background, I would now like to address three guidelines that have come out literally in the last 4 years. They're actually far more than we would anticipate compared to the preceding 10 or 15 years, when guidelines were less commonly renewed or reintroduced. But we are first going to talk about the 2013 European Society of Hypertension and European Society of Cardiology guidelines on hypertension. And in the interest of time, I will briefly touch upon this and focus a little bit more on the newest guideline that got introduced towards the end of October 2017. So the European Society guidelines classify hypertension a little differently from the other two guidelines and included terms like optimal for blood pressure below 120 systolic, below 80 diastolic. They describe normal as 120 to 129 and 80 to 84 for systolic and diastolic. And then went on to use terms such as high normal, grade 1, grade 2, and grade 3 hypertension. They used the term isolated systolic hypertension. The term still stands and is generally accepted by all the guidelines as blood pressure above 140 systolic and below 90 diastolic. And this is particularly common in the old. The European Society guidelines stated that in general, for those who are below 80 years, it makes sense to bring the blood pressure down to below 150 systolic, somewhere between 150 and 140. And if they are fit adults below 80 years, even attempt a systolic blood pressure below 140. for those who are over 80 years old, if the blood pressure was over 160 millimeters, attempt to bring this down to between 150 and 140. In diabetics and patients with chronic kidney disease, the aim of the systolic blood pressure target should be below 140 millimeters of mercury based on this guideline. The guidelines also mentioned that any one of the five categories of drugs were appropriate: beta blockers, diuretics, calcium antagonists, ACE inhibitors, and angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. Any of the five were appropriate as initial choice. They included alpha blockers, effective as third-line therapy for hypertension. So these are some differences from the U.S. guidelines, which do not promote the use of beta blockers or alpha blockers. We next will talk about the Joint National Committee guidelines, or the JNC guidelines, introduced in 2014, the JNC 8, within months of the European Society guidelines. The JNC guidelines made it very simple. They used the terms normal for below 120 by 80, prehypertensive, they used the word prehypertensive for 120 to 139 systolic, 80 to 89 diastolic, and then just stage 1 hypertension for 140 to 159 by 90 to 99, and stage 2 for over 160 systolic and over 100 diastolic. So they made it rather simple: normal, prehypertensive, stage 1, and stage 2. They looked at four factors: age, race, diabetes, and kidney disease. Age-wise, in those 60 and older, if the blood pressure was elevated, the initial treatment target would be below 150 systolic and below 90 diastolic. This was a grade A, a strong recommendation. If the person was diabetic, the guideline suggested a systolic blood pressure below 140 and a diastolic below 90. And likewise, for the person with CKD, a systolic blood pressure below 140 and a diastolic blood pressure below 90. As an approach to the choice of drugs, the JNC guidelines suggested in the general non-black population, including those who had diabetes, a choice between thiazide diuretics, calcium channel blockers, ACE inhibitors, or receptor blockers. By that I meant ARBs. Any one of the four. In the event it was a black patient, the choice of drug should initially be either a thiazide or a calcium channel blocker. If optimum blood pressure control was not achieved within a month, one would consider adding a second drug from a different class. They also stated that an ACE and an ARB should not be used together in the same patient. So thus far, I have finished two sets of guidelines, and I will now include very brief information on three trials before we go on to the most current guideline. The first trial was known as the HIVET trial, H. It's hypertension in the very elderly trial, published in 2008 in the New England Journal, where a review of patients who were over 80 years old with a target to bring the blood pressure below 160 with either a diuretic or a placebo showed substantial benefit with a reduction in blood pressure in terms of a lower number of strokes, cardiovascular events, and death. So this is a trial which proved that treating the very elderly was beneficial. A next study, also in the relatively old, where they looked at patients who were over the age of 60, called the ACCORD trial, studied diabetics. And the question raised here was, is there any evidence from trials to support a strategy to lowering the blood pressure below 135 to 140 millimeters of mercury systolic in a person with diabetes mellitus, type 2 diabetes mellitus? A study of over 4,700 patients, men and women, randomized to standard therapy with a blood pressure target of below 140 or intensive therapy below 120 systolic. Intensive therapy did not reduce the rate of composite outcomes in terms of fatal and non-fatal major cardiovascular events. So it showed that intensive therapy in diabetics did not prove as beneficial. The one that really brought up a lot of new information and has changed the current guidelines is known as the SPRINT study. The SPRINT study got tremendous exposure and a lot of talk. What is a SPRINT study? It's a randomized trial of intensive versus standard blood pressure control, where they randomized over 9,000 participants to usual care below the age of 140 systolic. And you can see most of them are looking at the systolic blood pressure, because as you get old, the diastolic goes down. So there's a saying, treat the systolic and the diastolic will take care of itself. So below 140, the usual arm, and the intensive arm below 120 millimeters of mercury. The outcomes were MI, coronary syndrome, stroke, heart failure, and death from any cause. Now, the overall age of patients in this study was 67.9 as a mean, but the number of patients over 75 was a quarter of this whole number of patients, a quarter. It was actually 28.2. So let's see what they found. Standard arm versus intensive arm. And it showed that the primary outcome for MI, coronary syndrome, stroke, heart failure, and death from any cause was far better with the intensive treatment arm. And death from any cause, as I just said, was included in this. So there was a definite difference, and this difference was manifest at the end of just over 3 years of the study. Looking further, in the intensively treated arm, there was a slightly higher likelihood for low blood pressure or hypotension, syncope, and electrolyte abnormalities, to be expected if the blood pressure was more intensively treated. Did these patients have a problem walking, basically gait dysfunction, just because the blood pressure was lower? The answer was no. What was the difference in the way they handled the two groups of patients? The usual care patients went to the doctor periodically based on the physician direction. There was no set frequency. They were just treated. There were no specific targets. In the intensively treated arm, there was a very organized, precise setup where patients had multiple readings, a team approach, free medications were given. There was a strict review of adherence to regimens, and so the monitoring was intense and closer. So it showed that a trial where the care was intense did produce better results. Having said that, are we going to now use this data? How are we expected to apply this data? So it is important to note that in the SPRINT study, they did not include patients with prior stroke, diabetes mellitus, heart failure, or CKD with a GFR below 20. What does this mean? In our real life, older patients have some or many of these problems. So relatively speaking, the SPRINT data had healthier patients. So what are we supposed to do? In these patients, when you bring the blood pressure down to as low as 120 systolic, they did well. Taken together, it suggests that you need to individualize the data. You may not be able to apply the SPRINT data to every individual, but a sizable number will benefit from strict control as shown in the SPRINT data. Now, there are many, many other additional trials, just to name them. There's the CIST-Euro trial, there's a CIST-China trial, there's a SHEP trial, and I'm going to skip all of these in the interest of time. So having gone this far, how low should we go? There was an editorial that came out in the middle of 2017, just before the new guidelines came out, a very simple approach where this was written by Injama, by Chobanian, and he stated, if the patients are below the age of 50, target below 120/80, between 50 and 74, target below 130, systolic, look at how they're all talking about systolic, and if you're over 75, target below 140. And he says, in particular, if you have chronic kidney disease or diabetes, one need to target these patients a little more intensely. So in other words, the general direction is below 120 or below 130, but not below 150. Even in the oldest people, he suggested below 140. So now in the last part of my talk, I'm going to talk about the 2017 ACC, AHA, and while I'm simplifying by saying ACC, AHA, there were many other societies involved in these guidelines, including the American Geriatric Society. And they call this the guideline for the prevention, detection, evaluation, and management of high blood pressure in adults. It's a document that runs over 400 pages. And let me just summarize some changes, dramatic changes. The first general comment made by the first author is the terms pre-hypertension and high normal are not used in this guideline because they have the potential to be misleading. So we shouldn't be saying pre or borderline or high normal. Okay, so what do they want you to say? This is the new classification. The blood pressure is either normal, if it is below 120 and below 80, elevated, 120 to 129, diastolic can still remain below 80. Stage 1, 130 to 139 systolic, 80 to 89 diastolic. Stage 4, above 140 systolic and above 90 diastolic. There was a long time ago when we called a patient hypertensive if the blood pressure was over 140 systolic, and now that patient is considered to be stage 2. So one more time, normal, elevated, hypertension stage 1 and stage 2. And this means that more people are going to be considered to be hypertensive based on this classification. And the guideline actually states so, that more people are likely to have to not only be labeled as hypertensive, but to be treated. Now, basic testing, which I did not address thus far in the preceding guidelines, because let's look at the new guideline and their recommendation, would include in any hypertensive a blood count, fasting glucose, sodium, potassium, and calcium. Potassium is always important because if you have unprovoked hypokalemia, that means the potassium that is low in the absence of diuretic use, it calls for an evaluation for secondary hypertension. Calcium, I mentioned. Lipids, it's an associated risk factor. Thyroid stimulating hormone, because thyroid disease is associated with hypertension. A simple urine analysis and a 12-lead cardiogram. That's your basic workup. Optional tests to be individualized include quantitative proteinuria, echocardiogram, and uric acid. Uric acid is important, especially if one uses diuretics and you get a subsequent uric acid, it is nice to know whether to start with the uric acid was elevated or not. Now, since it's an ACC guideline, they always would like to look at your 10-year ASCVD risk or atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk in all these patients who are hypertensive. And if the risk is 10% or higher, a BP target should be below 130/80. Remember, at 140, it's already stage 1. So you want below 130. So 120 to 130 is elevated, and they want it below 130. And if you do not, and for this, it's confirmed hypertension and known cardiovascular disease or a 10-year risk that is over 10%. For those who have hypertension without any additional markers, a blood pressure below 130 may be reasonable. So the first time they said it's recommended, here they say it's reasonable. So in general, they want you to get the blood pressure below 130. Recommendations should always begin with non-pharmacological measures, which include weight loss. Even a kilogram reduction will add value. The DASH diet, which I already alluded to, recommended for everybody. And I think it's a generally good diet for a variety of disorders besides hypertension. Dietary sodium restriction to below 1,500 milligrams per day, preferably below 1,000. So below 1,500 is the current U.S. dietary guidelines recommendation. A diet rich in potassium. Potassium elevation should not be attempted with medications. It's purely diet. And of course, factoring in the extent of kidney disease that these patients might or might not have. because they may not be able to tolerate an elevated potassium dietary intake. And exercise in one form or the other, the simplest would be aerobic, about 150 minutes a week. The best exercise would be walking, but could be dynamic resistance or isometric resistance. And moderation in alcohol intake to below 2 drinks per day for men and below 1 drink daily for women. Alcohol is not to be recommended, but should a person decide to drink, that is the limit. Now, the primary agents are consistent with what the JNC guidelines stated. You could use a thiazide, you could use an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, or a calcium channel blocker. They repeat, the simultaneous use of an ACE and an ARB or a renin inhibitor is harmful and not recommended. There are many additional drug classes, but evidence is lacking. They don't make a mention of it. They do say there's inadequate evidence to support the use of beta blockers as initial choice in the absence of cardiovascular comorbidities. And finally, avoid two drugs from the same class, exception being two diuretics with opposing effects. So in general, beta blockers have not been promoted in the US guidelines in contrast to the European guidelines. Now, the next thing is, even if you're normotensive, they suggest an evaluation of your blood pressure every year. But those who are hypertensive should have more intense follow-up. I'm not going into details regarding the frequency of follow-up, but that should be individualized, and they do offer some information based on the stage of hypertension. There's one more comment. If you have stage 1 hypertension, these patients should be managed with both non-pharmacological and antihypertensive drug therapy to start with. And should you have stage 2 hypertension, they even recommend considering two agents, two drugs of different classes to start with. In CKD, the goal now, according to this guideline, should be below 130 by 80 millimeters. Should you have albuminuria, an ACE inhibitor may be considered. Those who do not tolerate ACE inhibitors may be candidates for ARBs. If you have diabetes mellitus and hypertension, again, a goal below 130 by 80 is recommended. Any drug can be used in the diabetic, any of the four choices that have been commented on. An ACE on an ARB may be considered should a patient have albuminuria. So what happens to the older people? You're going to be surprised that the recommendation here, it's a class 1 recommendation, is that in older people, a target goal should be for a systolic blood pressure below 130 millimeters of mercury in those who are not institutionalized and who are ambulatory. So that's a pretty strong recommendation. And for those who are above 65, but who have a high burden of comorbidity and limited life expectancy, they ask for a team-based approach and to individualize the intensity of lowering of the blood pressure. There is no specific number being mentioned. So in general, for old who are fit and non-institutionalized, is below 130. In the event a patient is going for surgery, a few basic principles. If you're on a beta blocker, continue the beta blocker. If you're not on a beta blocker, do not start the beta blocker at the last minute. Some consideration to the continuing or discontinuing of ACE and ARBs. This is relatively new information in the last few years, the safety of ACE and ARBs in the perioperative period. Delay in surgery may be considered if the blood pressure systolic is over 180 and or a diastolic over 110. So you've got a lot of margin there. And do not abruptly stop a beta blocker or clonidine if the patient is already on these drugs. So with that, what I want to tell you the takeaways from the 2017 clinical practice guidelines are, classification of blood pressure and definition have completely changed. This results in a larger proportion of the US population as likely to be diagnosed as having hypertension. Non-pharmacological therapy is the recommendation for most newly diagnosed hypertensives. Formal assessment of a 10-year atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk drives the treatment threshold and target. For most patients with hypertension, lower BP targets and greater intensity of treatment is recommended. That's a general rule, lower BP target and greater intensity of treatment. And they recommend team-based care where applicable. I would also like to conclude by saying there's a dramatic increase in hypertension prevalence with aging. The aging hypertensive typically has an elevated systolic blood pressure with a normal or low diastolic blood pressure due to age-associated factors. Trials in general now confirm the substantial reduction in adverse cardiovascular outcomes, yet blood pressure control seems to be suboptimal nationwide. You could use any one of the four classes of drugs, diuretics, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and calcium channel blockers. And in general, in older people, start medications at a low dose with gradual increments as tolerated. The choice of drug will be based on tolerability, efficacy, comorbidity, and cost.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Dharmarajan.
Thank you.